One of the themes that will emerge here is that there are different applications for individual species, and those will be thrashed out either as an assessment by assessment and reviewed by the individual SARCs. And there's also some long-term research or longer-term research that came out of some of the reviewers' reports that won't happen in the next 3 months and won't happen maybe for the next assessment, but maybe a longer-term refinement on it. But we do have a way forward in the short term, and I'll talk about that in the conclusions as far as the reviewers' recommendations. For those of you who want to cut to the chase, the reviewers' recommendations are in this independent panel review. And there are a very series. There are a series of very pragmatic recommendations. The reviewers were a varied but very experienced group. The chair of the group, Stephen Walsh, has retired from DFO in Canada, where he's been has an international reputation in fish behavior and gear research. Stephen Smith is a mathematical statistician from DFO Canada. He's worked on their calibration. Walsh and Smith have worked on calibration efforts in Canada before. Mark Kaiser is a statistician from Iowa State. He was part of our original design panel, and he has a background in wildlife statistics and brings an academic perspective to the process. The reviewers' reports are on the website listed at the bottom. I'll zip through these because you've all seen the vessel changes. The big changes we have a quiet ship now, an auto trawl system, and a bigger scale. Our these wing spread meters, you can translate that into yards. We've got a net now with a wider wing spread. We've got up to 9 more feet of head rope height. The mesh has changed now to a taper design so we don't lose as many small fish out the large meshes in the back end of the caught end. And the liner, we've increased the liner size, the mesh size in the liner a little bit, because just to get the water flowing through the net, and also it also makes it a little more durable to dogfish catches. We also made some door changes. We got the bridle angle down. For anybody who's interested in that, Russ was stumped on that a couple of years ago, and so now he feels duty-bound to include that information. and we've got a rock hopper sweep that tends the bottom much better than the roller. We made some protocol changes at the same time. If we're going to change the net and change the vessel, if we have anything we want to do operationally to change it, we did that at the same time. We reduced the tow speed. There is no tow speed that's perfect for every species. It's going to be too slow for some, too fast for others. If we go faster than 3 knots, we lose the bottom tending capability of the gear, and overspread and the head rope goes down. We decreased the tow duration because the catchability of this net is so large that if we end up processing an entire catch from a 30-minute tow, we'd severely impact our ability to cover the number of stations that we really want to. We've used some improved instrumentation to base our tow definition on the actual time on the bottom as opposed to when the guy locks the winches. The outcome of our experimental design workshop, just as a little bit of review, we took two approaches. One was a shadow survey approach. So the albatross went out, did his normal random stratified survey, and the Bigelow followed behind. And then we occupied some stations that weren't random that were supposedly areas of high fish concentration or high density. And this was to kind of flesh out our portfolio of observations for species. Couple other recommendations from the panel were to minimize the disturbance effect by separating the vessels by about a quarter to a nautical mile, and then evaluate the effects of the rock hopper versus a cookie sweep later on, and work with just the rock hopper bottom gear at the beginning so that we get a precise rock hopper based estimate as opposed to two imprecise estimates, one for cookie, one for rock hopper. When it turned out to execute the experiments, we ended up with a total of 636 usable paired tows. This is about half what we were hoping from the original design. There's typos in terms of the dates of the second two surveys. They were all undertaken in 2008. So we managed to implement part of a shadow survey in the spring, a site-specific survey in June, which wouldn't have been our late May or June, which wouldn't have been our preferred time, but that was when ship time was available, and then finally a fall shadow survey and some site-specific work. And this covered areas, you can see in the spring, we had some, let's see, where's that? There. We had some mechanical problems here, and the Bigelow ended up having to go home, so we missed that part with the Bigelow and that chunk there. In June, we went out and occupied some stations here to flesh out our portfolio of groundfish observations. Here, we were looking for monkfish, scup, and black sea bass, and we were less successful. We also implemented this again in the fall. And here's a quick outline in terms of what it looks like when we're doing one of these experiments. The albatross starts off. We give them a head start. They get to about here. And then the Bigelow starts towing, so they're offset on a diagonal throughout the paired tow. And so that's the theory, and here's some actual performance where you look at where this is the albatross cruise track, and that's the Bigelow, parallel but shorter. So we want to give the albatross a head start so it doesn't get interference effects by the Bigelow, so we still have a legitimate survey observation, but we leave the Bigelow offset by at least between a quarter and a half mile, and then they end up with about a 15-minute to a half-hour head start. After we got these data back, we ended up with a lot of data screening. One of the things that we also implemented in the survey was a lot more quality control aspects than we had been able to with the previous gear. And so that's one of the side benefits of this operation. We screened, in this case here, for effects of temporal offset, where there's some really weird tows that had long time lags or long spatial lags, and it turns out in some cases, way out in the deep water, we couldn't get a side-by-side tow in the same depth area, so we had to have end-to-end tows. So there are some outliers there that aren't fatal flaws. They're a fact of doing business in some of those parts of the habitat we're looking at. We also improved the tow evaluation criteria. The big improvement here is in the operational angle, where we now have good information on tow duration, vessel speed. We can figure out if the tow's in the stratum boundaries much better than we used to. We can track trawl geometry with instrumentation better than we could before. So this is a whole new system now that we're looking at in terms of evaluating tow. Tow quality. So that's a side benefit of this process. I'm going to go through some descriptive results, and if there's something specific that you would like to see later, let me know. When we're in the process of putting together this final report, we want to include things that are useful to people. I know Dave was interested in the scatter plots of Bigelow catches versus albatross catches. This will give you some of the flavor of the kinds of things we're looking at. The problem is that a lot of this has been done for for something like 300 species at once, and you're probably not interested in fawn cuscules, but I'll hit some of the major species here as examples. First of all, we'll look at what we have for our sample sizes. If you can't really come up with any kind of a calibration exercise unless you have two tows that both catch the species. So to read this chart, you can look across this top line. If there's a plus Bigelow and plus albatross, that means that in a paired tow, both the Bigelow and the albatross caught that species. In this case, we had 407 cases out of those 600 usable tows where both boats caught silver hake. This column reflects the number of tows where the Bigelow caught something and the albatross caught nothing. And this column reflects the number of tows where the Bigelow caught nothing and the albatross caught something. And you can see right away that there's a lot more tows here where the Bigelow caught something and the albatross caught nothing. But you can also see that for some of these species, we have really impressive sample sizes. And this is in the top tier here for things like silver hake, spiny dogfish, little skate. We do well on scallops, herring, squids, winter skates. We have impressive sample sizes, haddock. The flounders we did very well on, those site-specific tows along with the kind of help to flesh that out. Redfish we have good sample sizes for. I don't know if you want to call this problematic. If I go backwards here, cod is not on this plot, but it would weigh in at about 94 positive paired toes. So it's not as nowhere near as good as haddock, but we do have a decent sample size for cod. Some of the places where we have lower sample sizes, monkfish may be a problem because we have huge catches in the Bigelow, and a lot more positive catches, and nothing in the albatross. That may be a little small to work off, but it's not may not be insurmountable. Thorny skates, clear nose skates, all the rest of the skates except for rosette skates generally had between 48 to 52 observations. And finally, stuff that we are really kind of in not the best shape are for pollock, and then some other species like striped bass, halibut, cusk, where we just don't have any data at all to make much of a comparison. So if you want a quick thumbnail sketch in terms of what an early warning system in terms of where you're going to have problems and where you're not, it's going to be species with low common positive occurrences. So anything that has a low number in that column, and this goes on for pages and pages of species, but these are the highlighted ones that I've picked out here. If there are other specific ones you're interested in, I can make sure that they're in summary tables for you. We compared the link frequency distributions from the two nets as well. Now, bear in mind, we had a larger mesh size in the liner, so we might lose some of the smallest fish potentially, but we also had a taper at the end of the tapered meshes in the end of the new four-seam trawl, and so that might serve to help retain some small fish, and that seems to be the case here in a lot of species. In this case here for cod, the top, and I apologize for the print, you might squint at your handouts for this. The top in each one of these are arrayed in pairs. The top one is the albatross, and the second one is the Bigelow. And so we've got albatross compared with Bigelow for the same cruise. So we've got the spring survey, our June site-specific sampling, and then I'll flip to the autumn survey later on. But you can see that Bigelow is catching smaller fish here, but it looks like there's an indication they may not be catching as many large fish as the albatross might have. And here's the example from the fall survey. Again, it's doing much better at small fish than our previous trawl. In the case of haddock, again, it looks like we're doing a little better for small fish potentially, and this will show up again in the fall survey. The scales here, in some cases, the Bigelow catches are almost twice what the albatross catches are. So we're doing better proportionally here on small fish. And here the maximum value is about 600 fish, and here the maximum value is 400 for the same number of toes. For Acadian redfish, the Bigelow is picking up more small fish, but it looks like, potentially, if you squint, it looks like they're picking up potentially fewer large fish. And I can show this more effectively later on in a later slide. And here's that same pattern in the fall. American plaice, again, we're doing better with small fish. Looks like the net's performing about the same on the large part of the spectrum. That's the fall survey. Yellowtail flounder. It looks like the length composition is about the same, except for a few more small fish. Winter flounder, it's the same story. You've got this peak here, and then a lot of variability out here, but approximately the same slope. And here's one with a lot of samples in the fall and more dense distribution, and they're getting about the same maximum sizes. So that's the picture story. We get into the analytic results, and it's a little harder to describe because we start to get into the realm of mathematical statistics. If I were going to go into that and explain to you in a lot of detail the difference between the candidate estimators, you'd have about five or six slides full of Greek letters. And I figured I'd just try and talk through a little bit in terms of some generalities of what we did and then what we're where we're going to go forward. So, and this is work done by Tim Miller primarily. He had the lead on looking at estimators. The classic estimator that we usually think of for calibration is what's called a ratio estimator. So that's just the simple, if the albatross caught two and the Bigelow caught four and then the albatross caught eight and the Bigelow caught 16, it's like 1 to 2. So it's pretty simple. It's a classical estimator, and it's pretty if you've got a good design, it'll work well. If you have some different characteristics in your and you want to use a different kind of an estimator, you can look at different estimators that have different assumptions about the density of fish. Are the fish patchy? Are they patchy? Do they have patchy distributions, for example? Do they have what's called Poisson distributions, where it's mostly ones and zeros and then an occasional big value? There is also the potential in here to consider the distribution of the calibration factor. So the calibration factor might have some variability in it that you could attribute to depth or season. And there's also even a case here where Dave said, Pierce said, there's some places where the toes aren't even don't look like they're correlated. And there are some models that you can use where you don't have a nice one-to-one correlation in terms of a linear relationship of catch by one vessel versus the other. If you've got a kind of a poorly formed scatter of points, there are some models that you can use to apply for that. So here's the basically in words on the screen what I just told you. There's a lot of there are some different assumptions in each one of those models about how fish are distributed and how if you want to have variability in the calibration factor and if there's correlation. So based on some simulation models, there was one estimator that seemed to behave best. It had low bias and it was fit well. And if it turned out that the data were generated from one type of distribution and you applied this other model based on a different distribution, it was robust. So if, let's say, if you assume that fish are distributed Poisson, you get the right result using this estimator, whereas other estimators wouldn't be able to match as well. And there's a whole lot of diagnostics that you can use on this, or a series that were involved in this estimator evaluation. And this was reviewed by the review panel. One thing that this model has is the ability to reflect some variation in each vessel's catchability coefficient. So this means that it's possible that under some conditions, say some substrate conditions, the albatross catchability coefficient or the albatross catchability may vary one way and the Bigelow catchability may vary in a different way. So there's a lot more information and a lot more factors affecting variability that you can include in this kind of a model rather than just your ratio where it's like just one size fits all. So there's some inherent variability in the catchability that you can quantify using this model. It turns out that this particular model, you can put all kinds of different parameters in. Depending on the species, you may want to – some of the models indicated that there was a difference in catchability between site-specific versus shadow toes or spring versus fall, so that you can put these different factors in and evaluate whether that's appropriate for the species that you're looking at. So you can tailor-make this kind of a model to adapt to each species to find the best set of fits. So we looked at, basically boiled down to two model candidates, the ratio estimator, which is a classical one, and that's essentially the ratio of all the catch of the albatross to all the catch of the Bigelow. And the alternative, the beta binomial, is more like looking at the average of those ratios. So if you think of each one of these values, that was in the first toe, and that's the albatross value in the first toe, and that's the Bigelow value in the first toe, albatross value in the second toe, Bigelow value in the second toe, albatross in the third, Bigelow in the third. So you pool all the albatross observations and all the Bigelow observations and divide one by the other. And there are some correction factors that you would do in this case, but that's rudimentarily it. This beta binomial, if you want to simplify it, is more like the average of those ratios. So in the first toe, you caught 5 in one, 10 in the other. The second toe, you caught 2 to 15. The third, you caught 3 to 10. And then you take the average of all of those. So this has a different this has a different effect depending on whether the toes are patchy or not. And I'll talk a little bit about why you would want to use one versus the other under certain conditions. And the review panel got into that as well. We, Tim, looked at models to evaluate catch and weight. And so there are some other distributional models that you can combine the calibration factor that you got for numbers with another estimator that you can use for weight. And you can also incorporate effects of season or station type on top of vessel to come up with a calibration factor for weight. So this builds on the number coefficient and then incorporates a weight coefficient. So, again, there's a preferred model form identified for each species, and it's difficult for me to summarize this because there are about 100 species, and then for each one of the alternative model possibilities. And so, for example, there's three different model possibilities and a bunch of statistics. You have to shop through to find each one, but the point is that there is a preferred model form for each one of these species that fits it best. It looks like, in a lot of cases, it doesn't make any difference that whether your weight coefficient varies by season or not. However, some species did show a difference in terms of seasonal weight. So in one case, you would interpret this as saying that the weight conversion from one vessel to the other varies by season. And that may be because of different length compositions between those two vessels. So that earlier on in the year, if one vessel is catching more smaller fish, that weight coefficient may be influenced by that. We also looked at length specific calibration factors. This could vary from coming up with a calibration factor for each size interval versus a single factor across all of the length classes. So there are some examples where the constant factor didn't work too well, and then there are some cases where you have functions smoothed through those that varies by species. And this is where I apologize for this example. In red it says refer to handout. So if you have your handout, you can look at something that has some page numbers at the bottom. And the thing to look at across the x-axis here, this is length, and then this is the calibration coefficient. So when it's high, it means that it's catching a lot, that the Bigelow is doing better than the albatross, and when it's low, it means that the albatross is doing better than the Bigelow. And so this is a graphical comparison on a length interval by length interval basis of those length frequency analyses that I showed you earlier. So you can see here, if we had one constant average value, we might be underestimating the small ones and overestimating the large ones. And you can page through for each one of those species and look at the same patterns in this case, where we've come up with an estimator for a conversion coefficient for each one of those length intervals. If you turn to the second set of pages, that'll be the second page that has two sides to it. You can see a curve run through that. And so that smooths all the variability from length interval to length interval That isn't shown on this chart here, but it is shown in your handout on the bottom that says, where the bottom says, page 277. So this is probably the one part that's outstanding in terms of development, is to figure out how to smooth those kind of jumpy observations in cases where we don't have a lot of fish, especially at, say, some small sizes or some very large sizes, to make that a more continuous function. So the primary output from the reviewers was a set of protocols to choose between the application of a ratio estimator or a beta binomial estimator. These two were the top candidates that came out of the review process, and they proposed that if they both give the same result, that that the beta binomial has this additional information in terms of the variability of catchability from toe to toe, and you can add the model, add length to the model as a continuous variate, which is what is English for the, or statistics for the pictures that you see on 277 and 278, where you see some lines fitted through there. We have to figure out what's the appropriate candidate line to fit through. If it turns out that your ratio estimator gives you a bigger value than your beta binomial estimator, a lot of times this is because you have patchy catches, and they saw this in the Bigelow with schooling pelagics. If the beta binomial is less influenced by large catches on one vessel, and that's because of, remember, when you look back to that ratio of the average of the ratios, that large catch only affects one observation, whereas if you use the ratio estimator, it gets thrown into the pool with everything else, and it can swamp all the rest of the observations. And so if your ratio estimator is less, and this usually happens when both of the vessels get large catches, but the Bigelow gets some small catches, when the Albatross gets zero, use the ratio estimator. Again, this is because those large catches contain a lot of information that if you've got a ratio that's based on 200 fish to 250 fish, that's a lot more, you have a lot more information there than one that says, well, we got one here and two there, or one there and five there. So you have a bigger single sample size. So this enables you to use that information, and that estimator is sensitive to that. Let's see, did I have? Okay. They also made some rule of thumb suggestions. This isn't based on a specific statistical analysis, but I would say it was more the collective wisdom of the group. They said there was nothing hard and fast about it, but it was a guideline that if you end up with fewer than a sample size of 30, you're not going to have enough information to really give yourself a good conversion. And again, you can look at that on a case-by-case basis. If you had 30 perfect observations that looked really well-behaved, you might want to try that. If you've got 30 that look like it's a lot of noise and you're going to have to fit a lot of extra parameters to make it work, it wouldn't be a very good a very wise approach. Likewise, if you think there's a seasonal effect, for example, there's no reason why you should assume that fish are as available and relatively catchable to the two trawls in the fall as they are in the spring, depending on their reaction time, for example, or their potential swimming speed. If you don't have 30 toes in a season, don't try to put in a seasonal conversion effect. And finally, if you've got between 31 and 50 toes in a season, that do it if you absolutely have to, but be pretty cautious about it. So these are rules of thumb in the short term to get us through, let's say, the first round of assessment applications while we look at additional model formulations and additional improvements on what we have. You only have two of the reviewers' sets of comments. The third reviewer's comments, if you've gone to the website, is about 70 pages. That's from the academic, and he put out a very nice research program that would be very nice to follow over the next 5 years, but it's not going to be anything that we're going to be able to implement, you know, tomorrow or by the next SARC. So we've got some long-term potential directions from the academic side of the house and some very pragmatic short-term projection recommendations from the pragmatists in the group. And, of course, if you don't have any catches in either vessel, you're not going to get any reliable estimates. And they specifically identified pollock where the where there was one single large catch in one vessel, and those group, those species at the bottom with hardly any observations. It's going to be we simply cannot go back in time and get more data. That's what we've got for those species. So there, and there's not any, we don't have any statistical tricks to do anything with four observations. If you've got, you know, 50 or 100 or 150, there are a lot of things you can try. But if you only got, you know, five or six observations, you can't do much. Statistics isn't going to save you. One of the other reviewers had put some additional comments on here that we should have looked at, separated out the site-specific surveys, because that would give us another another contrast in the data, and that we should figure out how to model the zeros. It's in all those cases where we have zeros in the Bigelow and pluses in the Albatross and zeros in the Albatross and pluses in the Bigelow. Can we get more information out of that kind of comparison? And then Kaiser's recommendation for a hierarchical approach that actually looks a lot like what we did, but organized a little differently. And they recommended some analysis, improvements to the analysis of age frequency comparisons. We did compare the age frequencies from the two vessels, and they're not catching older fish at length or younger fish at length. And the reviewers also commented that it was time limited. We had put together, I had budgeted about 3 days, 2.5 days for this review, and all of us frankly underestimated the amount of science that was produced and the amount of time that it took to go through it. You'll notice on this one sheet, it says you're on page 278, and you're not at the back of that document. So I have a ring binder about like that with just the working papers in there. So it was a lot to ask the reviewers to go through, and they did the best they could in the time they had, and we did as well. And we've ended up, again, with some pragmatic recommendations and some recommendations, pragmatic recommendations for the short term and then some longer term recommendations. Some other technical improvements that we can make in the future. Okay, so this is kind of the summary. You've probably seen this slide from Russ where we end up having overlap between current and future surveys, how much it's going to cost. It costs a lot to develop these comparisons. It costs a lot to transition in terms of intercalibration. And new surveys cost more money because you have more, you know, more sophisticated gear and more sophisticated monitoring. But what do you get for information? When you've got these two surveys going at once, when you just have one survey, you have a medium or a lower level of information. As you're doing the two surveys side by side, you increase the information, and then all of a sudden when you're not doing two surveys anymore, your information quality drops because you don't have that long time series for that survey. Meanwhile, you're hoping at the end that the additional information, the additional resources that you put in will, in the long run, give you a better product. However, at this point, oops, I'm going to flip past these arrows here. We're in this little trough here. And I'd say for some species, we have a very smooth transition. For some species, the transition is going to be very smooth. We have a lot of observations and a well-behaved estimator. The ones that we've used the results of this set of experiments indirectly in the butterfish assessment, in order to scale the catchability of the albatross. They didn't use the Bigelow index in there, but they used the information on the albatross catchability indirectly in there. And I think this is getting its first exercise this week in the dogfish assessment, and we have a pretty good sample size and a pretty good relationship for spiny dogfish. There are some species where It's going to take a little more excavation and a little more statistical work, and that'll probably happen in two ways, either in a general approach where we work forward on the model formulations for all the species at once, like we have before, 300 pages at a time, and then individually in the species assessments. So you may see in each assessment a section talking about the calibration coefficient and what ended up being chosen for the final model and why. And that component will end up being reviewed again in each one of those stock assessments, I anticipate. There are some species that we're probably just going to have to wait for the future time series to continue. For example, the wolffish and cusk, that where we had such low observations, where it'll be difficult right off the bat to make any kind of a link between our historical time series, but eventually the new time series will probably over 5 years will accumulate enough information to provide feedback on stock status for those species. So I appreciate your attention. I hope if you have feedback for specific components that you'd like to see in the report that we're assembling, let me know. And if there's places where you'd like more information or less, we'd like to put together a document that's useful in a management context in a long term to explain what we did and document how we did it. And also if there are short term products that would be helpful, we'd like to know that too, based on what we've got. Bearing in mind as well that we'll put it at the top of our priority list, but everything else is at the top of our priority list too. So,
thank you for that report, and I think it certainly gives the council a much more complete sense of the amount of work and effort that has gone into this calibration. Council members have any questions at this point? Mark?
Thank you, Wendy, for a nice presentation. On slide number 71, you mentioned that some of the reviewers suggested modeling of the zero frequencies, or at least further evaluation of that. And on slides 40 through 42, I noticed that in terms of toes where the Bigelow caught a species and the albatross didn't, it seems like skates and particularly monkfish really stand out. What are the particular implications in terms of abundance indices further down the road, and what information might they actually get from the fact that the new gear seems to be more efficient for those species?
That's part of it's a good question, because it's part of the problem that we always have when we deal with zeros is it really because there's nothing there, or we just didn't catch it? And so that would be where the where some of the additional modeling might be able to elucidate that. Paul Rago did a similar sort of analysis when he was looking at barn door skate a long time ago in the time series. That were they true? You know, what would be the impact if it was a true zero as opposed to something that was present and not detected? So I don't have a short answer for you as far as that goes, but it's a question of trying to see what additional information we can get out of that, more from a statistical framework than just saying, well, the albatross, some of those zeros in those albatross catches are because it's a patchy distribution and there just really weren't any fish where their toe pattern went. And in some cases, they might have rolled right over them. And I'm thinking, you know, for monkfish, that's an example. Some of them may also, I don't have a short answer for you, unfortunately.
Thank you.
But there is information there. We want to try and squeeze as much as we can out of what we have.
Thank you.
Anyone else in the council? Dave?
Wendy, the one I'm I can understand how you can deal with the ones that are fairly consistent. That doesn't really look all that difficult to me. The ones that are very inconsistent look like the problem children. And Pollock is an example now, is obviously something we're very concerned with. And it also seems to be one of the ones that came out with no discernible pattern. What are we going to do under those types of conditions? I mean, I'm sure it's going to be on a species-by-species basis, but with an index-based stock, are we just going to have to drop the index and come up with another method of estimating the population, or what?
I can't really speak for the person responsible for the Pollock stock assessment, because they probably have been – I know they've been lying awake nights worrying about this far more than any of the rest – or as much as any of the rest of us. So I think it's I don't know. It doesn't look like we have a lot of, you know, really strong a pattern that'll come out and hit you in the face in terms of what, you know, making building that gap or bridging that gap. And there may be something else if you start to look at the data on a really fine scale. But when you try and do that, in order to try and account for all of the little variabilities, you know, taking account that, you know, these were done at night and these were done, you know, during the daylight. Every time you do that, from a statistical perspective, you use up, I don't want to get into this too far, but you use up a degree of freedom. And so if you only have 29 observations, you can't fit 29 different, you can't use 29 effects, because then, hey, everything's, you've explained absolutely every single point by some unique pattern. So if we're looking for patterns that are regular and reproducible, we may not have enough observations to, say, discern between day versus night effects and the catchability that might drive those patterns. And I haven't been talking with the Pollock folks that much to find out what's on the radar screen for them in terms of how they're going to deal with that.
Can I just follow up? Is there any plan to take some of these problem children and maybe go out and do a targeted experiment on them in areas where you'd expect to catch them? In other words, instead of all over the range, let's go someplace where we think there's pollock. Pair the two boats up and do 25 or 30 tows, something like that. Or does anybody know?
Nancy?
Yeah. Pollock really stands out, there's no question about it. And quite frankly, I wasn't able to attend the workshop as much as I would have liked to, but I was there to see Pollock, quite frankly. And my first response coming out of that meeting was to go to my folks and ask if we should be shifting to some alternative platform to do Pollock work. And so Wendy's addressing some of the short-term issues, and of course we have the Pollock assessment that's coming up in June. But over the longer term, we're actually exploring the possibility of doing some experimental work, and in particular using industry-based vessels, and Pollock is one that we're focusing on. So we are, in fact, looking at some of these problematic species and trying to figure out alternative ways of perhaps sampling or doing some site-specific experiments to see if we can come to grips with the so-called variability, I guess, that we're seeing.
Anything further from the council? Anyone in the audience? Okay. Dr. Gabriel, thank you very much. Moving on to the next agenda item, the Red Crab Report.